Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend Show. I'm, as ever, your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing, man?
I'm okay, and yourself?
I'm pretty good, I must say. Well, at least as good as one can be for a Monday. And we are also joined by Dr. John Endres. John, how are you?
Very well, thanks, Nick.
Very good. All right, before we start, let me just quickly have a word from our sponsor. And once again, our sponsor is Bitvice. So Bitvice says that Bitcoin is the complete hedge against the global debasement of money, inflation, and government overreach. Bitvice is a South African-first, Bitcoin-only self-custody solution that helps individuals and entities buy and hold Bitcoin for the long term. Bitvice believes that everyone should hold their own Bitcoin and trust no one else. Recently, there have been a plethora of crypto custodians going bankrupt, taking their clients' Bitcoin with them. This is why Bitvice never holds your Bitcoin. They send it immediately to your own Bitcoin wallet, where you hold the keys. Not your keys, not your coins. Simply sign up to Bitvice, link your bank account securely, and buy Bitcoin in seconds. Visit bitvice.io and begin your journey in buying and securing the scarcest asset that mankind has ever created. And we thank them very much for sponsoring us once again. So let us get into the news stories of today. And the first one is one that I'm sure every South African is going to sort of smack their forehead and groan when they hear. It was actually announced live on the show last week that we had load shedding. And it seems like at least the short to medium term prospects are not particularly good, because news has come out of a factory in China where the Kuberg refurbishment project had sent one of the steam generation units for the Kuberg nuclear power plant, and apparently while undergoing some upgrades, it has been dropped on the ground. Now, this thing is 360 tons and 20 meters long, so presumably this has been quite a bit of a problem. When you drop something like that, it's not a small deal. And there are fears now that this could push the project back, which was supposed to finish in December of this year, and is very necessary for ensuring that Eskom is able to at least mostly stave off load shedding going into the next couple of years. There are some fears that if the project is not completed by December, that we may be in stage two or higher load shedding on a nearly continuous basis for possibly years, because remember that it's not just Kuberg that's not providing all the power it could right now. A lot of the old coal power stations aren't working properly as well. And also, Kuberg, it was built in the 80s, so it's relatively old, which is why it needs these upgrades in the first place. But it continues to be one of the most reliable and cheapest of all of Eskom's power stations, proving, I think, the value of nuclear power. John, let me start with you. What should we take away from this story? I guess it's just no inter-load shedding in sight.
So it gives us the feeling, I think, of the bad news just not stopping. You're hoping that you're going to catch a break at some point, but it's just one thing after another. And now it's this generating unit being dropped. That's very unfortunate. The reason why there's a bit of pressure on needing to finish the work is that the operating license of this power station is going to run out in 2024. And ideally, you'd want all the work to be done long before then, and all the inspections to be done by local inspectors and foreign inspectors so that the extension can be given. A 20-year extension, I think, is what Eskom is looking for. And if these units aren't ready by 2024, which is the operating deadline end, then we enter into territory where it might take another year or a few years to get the license, and during that time, Kuberg won't be able to generate power. And that would be very unfortunate, because it is, as you pointed out, a very reliable generator of electricity within the South African grid, which is desperately short of reliable generators, because so many of the power stations are quite old, keep breaking down, and suffer all sorts of breakdowns. So Kuberg is very important in the national energy mix, and it is unfortunate that these delays are taking place. It is also an extension, I think, of a stream of delays in the process. that is now getting us really close to that deadline. And it just reminds me of a series of processes in South Africa that are much slower than they should be. If you think of the grey listing, you know, we're approaching another deadline there, February next year. And again, it feels like we're just getting to grips with what we need to do to avoid grey listing very, very late and might miss the deadline. And in South Africa, in many circumstances, missing the deadline isn't such a big deal. But often international agencies are not quite as forgiving. You miss the deadline, you're out. Nicholas.
And of course, you know, we've seen this is not the only Eskom project that has been massively delayed. The two giant coal power stations, which were supposed to end load shedding. I'm sure we all remember the words of President Jacob Zuma when they opened the first unit at, I think it was Medupi power station said, and load shedding is never, ever, ever coming back. I wish he was right. Well, Terence, so is, you know, a lot of people are speculating that there might be good news on the horizon. The Ramaphosa faction of the ANC seems to be quite amenable to independent power producers, particularly those using renewable energy sources, and that those for there's a lot of talk from the president about these coming online and supplying the electricity grid, which I'm not sure how much it's going to do for cost of electricity, but at least availability of electricity it might be good for. And of course, there's also been talk about lifting the generation cap. So that, you know, let's say you have a big mine that has a lot of capital already invested, maybe they can generate their own power so they don't have to rely on Eskom without needing to get a government license to do so. Do you think that that we could be just at the sort of, is the fever going to break on load shedding, Terence?
No.
Could you elaborate, perhaps?
Oh, okay. Sorry. Just channeling my inner Jordan Peterson, he was asked something similar. I have to agree with one of our viewers. How do you drop something like that? I mean, this is like, it's a hell of a pair of butterfingers to drop something that's 20 feet long. I do, however, say that there's a certain Rocky One-esque moral victory here that at least we didn't drop it.
Eskom can at least breathe easy that it wasn't them who messed up this time.
Yeah, but there's something almost surreal about this. You know, what gods have we angered to you not only get Eskom but to get the Chinese dropping this 5 billion? I think quite seriously, there's been a lot of appetite for a number of years on the part of the private sector to put money into energy generation. There are lots of people who are keen to get on board the renewables train. So, you know, all of that stuff is in theory, set to go. I think that what happens though, what sort of still needs to be clarified is how this plays itself out in terms of, you know, what sort of demands, are the authorities going to put in place, you know, to give people the right to, you know, turn their lights on. I suspect that this is going to be seen as a massive cash cow. You know, and I think that sadly, our authorities are not always averse to accepting economic damage to, you know, to prove an ideological point. And I think that the most predictable factor here is likely to be empowerment demands.
Right. I mean, this is a thing we've seen over and over again where the minister or the president or someone announces a policy and then the bureaucracy just doesn't really do it. My favorite example of this, and I've mentioned it before on the show, is when the mining minister said that you don't need to be BEE compliant to get a prospecting license. And then it turned out the department refused to issue prospecting licenses to you unless you were BEE compliant.
Yeah, well,
just because.
I think that one of the underlying issues that we have is that we have been afflicted with a particular curse of a professional politician who has very little understanding of anything outside his or her sort of a political universe. I mean, a couple of years ago, there was a story that got some attention about a president Ramaphosa having to sack some workers from his farm because of the outbreak of foot and mouth disease. And it was like, you know, how could he possibly, you know, be doing this? Well, you know, that's the president acting as a businessman. When he enters cabinet, however, I think that those calculations don't just that, you know, you have to link your costs to your profitability and to whatever you can find down behind your sofa. They don't seem to carry much weight. You know, it's very cheap and easy to legislate.
Right, and you know, that was supposedly the tough attitude that he was going to bring to governing the country.
Yes,
seems not so much, but we'll get into that in a minute. John, any final thoughts on this topic before we perhaps move on?
Well, maybe just the comment that already the delays with the replacement of these steam generating units have cost Eskom over 800 million rand in penalties, and the French nuclear power company Framatome over 600 million rand in penalties, and that is for the original delay from 2018. So it's just incredible. I mean, considering the financial state of the country, the financial state of Eskom, to have almost a billion rand in penalties here is absolutely amazing. It is very, very tough.
Just money.
Just money, yeah.
Yeah, your just money, other too. People's money. Just our money. Right, and I do apologize to our listeners if there's some awkwardness at the end of the show, because I'm going to be load shed just as the show ends. But hopefully my UPS, which I've had to buy because of load shedding, kicks in time. But anyway, if you are enjoying the show and you are a regular listener, please do subscribe to us on YouTube. Leave us good reviews on the podcast apps. You can find us on all the podcast apps with Spotify, iTunes, all that good stuff. All right, let us move on to our next topic. And, I should have segued this better, but speaking of the president, there was an editorial in the Business Day very recently, which is titled, "Time is not on the president's side, but he behaves as if it is." And the editorial goes into talk about how President Ramaphosa has had some successes. However, these haven't been enough. He's moved too slowly on various reforms to fix problems in the country, and that this is not going to, he's not moving at a speed that is going to be able to either save his own political career or the country. It goes on to say, this editorial, you know, yes, much has been achieved under Ramaphosa. His biggest achievement, of course, was to disrupt the state capture project. Consequently, many important institutions such as the SA Revenue Service, the National Prosecuting Authority, and its Investigations Directorate, the police, the intelligence services, and the judiciary now have decent leadership at the helm. The editorial also goes on to credit Ramaphosa as, contrary to his party's wishes, the Reserve Bank has not been nationalized, and the ill-advised ANC resolution to expropriate land without compensation has stalled and is unlikely to see the light of day anytime soon. This is news to me. Terence, has the resolution to expropriate land without compensation stalled?
Look, I'm not a professional journalist, so maybe, you know, I'm reading fake news, but I seem to recall that at the ANC's policy conference, and that was about two, three months ago, they said explicitly, "We must go ahead with expropriation without compensation." I think it was those words. In fact, I can probably find it here somewhere. The president himself said that EWC is a tool that we must utilize. Okay, despite the setback of our efforts to amend Section 25 of our Constitution, which continues to pursue all available options, including through legislation like the Expropriation Bill, to implement the resolution of our 54th Congress Conference on Land Redistribution without compensation. You know, it's almost like that, like the writer of that editorial took that line and just cut out the inconvenient bits. But there it is, you know. There. Right there. So yes, you know, and no one other than the president himself is saying that this is that this is the intention. Yeah, so it's mind-boggling that this made it into print, or right. even
into that in the same way that the expropriation bill, which effectively does the same thing as the constitutional amendment.
And look, as for the parliament. And as for the state capture project, well, what do you think cadre deployment is? Something which the president, as you know, the head of state, not as the head of a political party, is using taxpayer money, you know, that should be going to buy big machines in China that they can drop on the floor, you know, going to court to say cadre deployments, you know, great. And see, I think that essentially what Ramaphosa was offering is fundamentally, you know, we'll be a little less crooked and, you know, like visibly crooked, and, you know, we'll do better state capture. I mean, how does that sound? How do you like them apples?
What's even worse, though, is that this claim for me that SARS has got better leadership, or perhaps that's true. The NPAs have better leadership, and yet it's still not prosecuting a lot of the people who very much should be prosecuted. The investigations directorate, the police, the intelligence services, and the judiciary all have better leadership. Well, you could make a case for some of those, maybe the judiciary. But the police, the intelligence services, it was under Ramaphosa's watch that the July riots, apparently with the police knowing nothing about them, broke out and massively damaged the economy and reputation of the country and put thousands of people's livelihoods on fire. I don't know what kind of parallel universe.
I'd say that our esteemed editorial writer there has mistaken something. Leadership may or may not be great, but you know, you're dealing with the accumulated damage of not just state capture and garden variety corruption. Well, actually, no, let's call it state capture, the whole cadre deployment thing, you know. The greatest misstep that post-apartheid South Africa made was in 1996-97 when the ANC deliberately set out to politicize the state, something which they refuse to step back from now. So, yeah, you know, no.
I think it's the word of this episode. John, so this kind of all raises the question, you know, Ramaphosa is kind of stumbling a bit, and he's not really able to, even as this editorial says, which is, I would say, very sympathetic towards him, unfairly so, that he doesn't have time, that his political prospects are in danger. And so what are the prospects of perhaps another faction of the ANC dethroning Ramaphosa and pushing forward with many of the so-called RET economic demands?
So, I mean, we had Khoza Zana Dlamini Zuma declaring her candidacy for the party leadership, I think over the weekend or just before. And that raises the question, you know, if the ANC should elect a different leader or different top six in December, what is going to change? And I think not very much. I do think that the entire top leadership of the ANC is on board with the current policy direction, which includes things like EWC, like BEE. They're failing to reform the schooling system. They are not upholding property rights. They're in favor of the big state, of high taxes, of the developmental state. And I do not think that a change of personnel would change anything in the direction of movement of the ANC. What it might do is change the speed of movement. In other words, you might get a sort of a slower breakdown of the state or a faster breakdown of the state, depending on who's at the helm. But the direction of travel is very clear. And I think there can be no misunderstanding that the entire party is on board with this. So when people talk about, you know, the reformist faction within the ANC or speculate about where reform is going to come from, it cannot possibly come from this party because there are no reformers. Everybody who's there buys into the program wholeheartedly. And so I don't think that we're going to see any change. It doesn't really matter who gets elected. The outcome will be the same. It doesn't matter. In terms of this editorial, I do think that the author was trying to be even-handed in a way, and so was trying to find some good things to say about Ramaphosa while criticizing him at the same time for being perhaps slow to act and too focused on compacting, et cetera, which is a fair criticism. But I think even the compensating explanations don't hold water. As you and Terence have pointed out, expropriation without compensation failed at the Constitution Amendment State last year. No thanks to Mr. Ramaphosa himself, who I think did nothing to, you know, slow down that process or halt it or reverse it. But now it continues. And I think that the editorial writer fell into the trap of complacency, of thinking that because the constitutional amendment was defeated, therefore expropriation without compensation wasn't going to happen. That's a big mistake. Now, you've covered this on the show before in terms of the Land Court Bill, the Unlawful Entry into Premises Bill, the Western Cape High Court judgment, the Prevention of Illegal Evictions Act. There's all sorts of laws that are already challenging property rights, and there are more laws on the cards right now that are going to reinforce that. So the challenges to property rights are very much on the table. Expropriation without compensation is very much on the table. It's going to come through the expropriation bill unless that gets stopped. And I think that any feeling of sanguinity or complacency is entirely misplaced. You cannot let your guard down with the ANC government. Their policies are destructive, and they're not moving away from them.
So, John, I just want to ask one more thing of you. I'm sure very regular listeners to the show will know that we often make this point that the ANC is ideologically quite coherent and that Ramaphosa is, as Gabriel Krauser has said it before, the head of the RET faction in at least the ways that matter, which is policy and legislation. Why do we make this point so often? Why do we feel the need to stress it, John?
I think it's because we sense that there is a maybe an effort behind this to pull the wool over the public's eyes, and we think the public should not fall for this. And the way it works is that you present the ANC as being composed of two parts, a good ANC and a bad ANC. And you say that President Ramaphosa represents the good ANC. He's protecting the rest of the country from the bad ANC. Therefore, he deserves our respect, our support wholeheartedly. But as a matter of fact, this is all a smokescreen. This is not the truth. As a matter of fact, there's only one ANC and it endorses the same program. So you should not be hoodwinked into thinking that Mr. Ramaphosa is the good guy who's protecting you from the bad guys. No, they're all on the same team. And that is why we keep on making this point, because we think it's very important to realize that. The press also tends to fall into this trap of believing this, I think slightly less over the past year than they did before. But as this editorial shows, you can still see some, you know, holdovers of this idea that Mr. Ramaphosa is the good ANC, you know, and as long as he's in charge, all will be well. And that is really not the way we read things. We think that is a mistaken reading of the situation, Nicholas.
Exactly.
If I may just add something to that, I think that an interesting comment in that editorial was to say, well, you know, the bar was set so low by Jacob Zuma that I think they said anyone with half a brain could do better. And I think there's a certain corollary there that we're so desperate for a savior that we'll take any mirage.
Right. No, that's exactly right. Because the alternative is much more difficult to wrap your head around.
I've seen otherwise very intelligent people far more highly credentialed than I, you know, posting things like on their social media accounts about how you have to put your trust in someone and Cyril's the man to put your trust in. I remember, you know, when we were locked down for the second or third time, I think it was Ndiwe Mazibuko, you know, she of the Active Citizenship Apolitical Academy fame. You know, oh, this is so wonderful. # we are led. I really like that. You know, we are led. I think there's something in Shakespeare's Othello as easily led by the noses as our asses or something like that. Shout out to Mr. Munro who did that with us in the trick. At the time.
Very good stuff. All right. So our last story, we don't have a huge amount of time for this, but I'll just quickly dive into it. Employment and Labour Minister Tula Sumplesi was recently speaking at the National Economic Development and Labour Council, NEDLAC. They had a summit on Friday, and he spoke at length about various things there, but he also spoke to the media on the side. And he said that he is very concerned with the way that businesses are currently punished for hiring low-skilled foreigners. Yeah, he's not talking about illegal foreigners, however, necessarily. He just says that businesses should be punished if they hire foreigners in low-skilled jobs instead of South Africans who already have those skills. He said, quote, "We have to be harsh on employers who employ these people. One of the things I want to propose is hard punitive measures for all employers who employ foreign labor when you have local labor, especially at a low-skilled level. They're the ones creating this problem. Business guilty of this practice must be fined a percentage of their turnover because current fines for this weren't adequate. We catch some of them and through the legal and take them through the legal process, but then they're given a slap on the wrist. If you're a farmer that makes 10 million rand a year and get a fine of 500 rand and a warning to say do not do it again, what is that? We must look at the legislation. The fine must be a percentage of turnover of profit. We must go very hard." He also went on to essentially blame foreigners for unemployment. He said, "What special skills do you need to work on a farm? What special skills do you need to work as a domestic worker? And what special skills do you need to work in the hospitality industry, like a restaurant where you service people? In most of these restaurants, it's rare that you find South Africans. For 20 staff members, you find there are only 5 South Africans." At the same time, Operation Dudula has called for government to declare a state of emergency over illegal immigration, saying SA has a crisis that should not be ignored. Just before I go to you, John, on this one, I must say that it really does rub me up the wrong way when someone says, what skills do you need to be a farm worker? What skills do you need to be a domestic worker? It's very easy to mess up those jobs. You have to show up on time. You have to work hard. Now, you don't have to go to school for those skills, but it does take self-discipline. It does take commitment. And it's this, and they're often skills that not everyone in the world possesses. And if you've ever tried to clean your entire house top to bottom, you will know very well that knowing what you're doing is a massive time and sweat saver. And to simply dismiss the skills of even so-called unskilled work, I think, is misguided. But anyway, John, what do you make of the minister's calls here? And it seems like the temperature really is rising on this immigration and employment issue.
So I can only echo your comments on the dismissiveness of the minister regarding certain types of jobs. I think it's completely misplaced. And what I'm also seeing in his comments is the sort of very socialist worldview kind of idea that views humans as cogs, interchangeable cogs in a machine. And so what the minister is revealing here is the idea that, you know, one warm human body is as good as another one. It doesn't matter. They're interchangeable. It doesn't matter if it's a South African or a foreigner. But ultimately, it is the employer or the business owner has to make those calls. And they have got skin in the game. If they get the call wrong, they suffer the consequences. It's not the minister who suffers the consequences. So I really think he should be butting out of this entire discussion. And employers should be allowed to hire who they choose on the conditions that they choose in order to get the job done. Because the employer is going to know what they need for the specific job in the specific situation. Let the minister and let the government focus on introducing fair conditions for entry to South Africa and also citizenship. But to go messing around like this, scapegoating foreigners, changing people as interchangeable cogs, I think is really very undignified, unsuitable, and not a good showing by the minister at all.
Nicholas. So Terrence, for a moment, let us consider the possibility that such legislation is passed and everyone fires their foreign workers. Are we going to see South Africans taking those jobs?
Well, I'm curious. What special skills are needed to be the Minister of Employment and Labour, since there is precious little of the former and a decreasing need for the latter? I don't know. It's just a thought. You know, to some extent, but I think that once again the economies don't function like fixed whole number equations. You may well find that somebody forced to part ways with, you know, their Zimbabwean carer might just decide to sort of contract the job to one of these companies that'll bring someone in and do it, just go through the house once a week. You may find that, restaurants, you know, might think that it just might make more sense to have like those little automations that you have at McDonald's where you can, you know, you don't have to, I mean, I can't make them work. So fortunately with my current dietary restrictions, I can't eat at McDonald's, which is just as well because like I just end up storming out in frustration because I think I've managed to make one order like that. But yeah, you know, you'll be surprised. You can find a way. Oh, we've just been load shed.
That's pretty good.
Speak to the devil and he's bound to appear.
Indeed.
very punctual.
John, in 30 seconds or so, any final thoughts before I get load shed?
Yeah, I think exactly as Terrence said, is exactly right. Don't let ministers make those kind of choices. Let employers make the choices. Don't dismiss work for being so-called low-skilled work. You know, I think especially with farm workers, for example, very easy to dismiss that. But that's, I mean, that takes a lot of knowledge, doing the job right, not getting it wrong.
There we go.
There goes your power as well.
Yeah, I certainly, being someone who is horrifically unfit and pasty, could not do farm work particularly well. But anyway, okay, that's all the time we have for today. We hope that you enjoyed the show, and we will, of course, see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Have a good one, everyone.